Let's go to the book of Numbers, if you would, please.
The book of Numbers is where we're going to be for the next several weeks, probably several months. It's, again, a little longer book. There's some 34 chapters in it, 36 chapters, as we work through it. So as we work through the book of Numbers, we're going to kind of be working through this series, entitling it Pilgrims Learning to Walk by Faith. We're in Numbers chapter 1. I want you to read that first verse. Take a look at that, if you would, there. Numbers chapter 1, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they'd come out of the land of Egypt. Basically, what that verse is saying is we're still at Mount Sinai. We've seen this picture a lot over the course of the past 2 years. But the nice thing is, we're going to leave Sinai, finally, over the course of this book. But we're still at Mount Sinai. When you take a look at the book of Numbers, what do you think of when you think of the book of Numbers? What are you anticipating as we come to this book, this study? You think of any stories or texts that jump out from the book of Numbers? The census, hence the book of Numbers. In fact, the book of Numbers, the title is taken from its Greek title, or from the Greek wording, and the word there is literally arithmoi, arithmetic, numbers, and that's because of the census, both in chapters 1 through 4 and then in chapter 26 later on in the middle of the book. What else do you think of in the book of Numbers? If that didn't get your heart beating this morning, nothing will. Arithmetic on Sunday morning. What's that? Families. Hey. Family. They numbered the families. Yes. So each of these numbers have names and faces. They're people. Some families find blessing. Some families together find cursing. What else do you think of in the book of Numbers? You can take a look, flip through it real quick. Do you see any titles in any of those chapter headings that look familiar? Spies. Okay, the spies story is found only here. This is where it happens, the book of Numbers. It's repeated in other places, but this is where that story happened. Okay, that's a good junior church material. When arithmetic doesn't work down in junior church, at least you can go to the spy story and you can carry the grapes of Eshkol on your shoulder. Balaam and Balak. Okay, which is which? Which is the king? Which is the prophet? Balak is the king. He has a K in his name. Balaam is the prophet. And what does he have that talks? A donkey, a mule. Okay, so there's that story. Okay, this one's only found here. Balaam's name is repeated a couple times in the New Testament. But that story is found here. Any other stories that we're familiar with from this book? The bronze serpent. Ah, so we come to John chapter 14, 15. Jesus says, as the serpent was lifted up in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That bronze serpent. It's an important one. Any other stories? Ah, Aaron's rod that budded. One of those stories, I think it's tucked in chapter 17. That's perfect. That's what I asked you to do. Yeah. But as you're working through these stories, a lot of these stories are stories that we talk about. We teach children. So as you looking at the book of Numbers, you might at first be going, oh, okay. But there's a lot of material in here that's accessible. That's accessible to us. Again, the title is taken from the census listings, but the Hebrew title is the fifth word in there, and the title is In the Wilderness. And that really captures probably better than anything what the what the feel of this book is all about. This is a story of life in the wilderness. They've been at the mount. They've been in the wilderness as they've been at the mount. But now they're going to leave the mountain. And they're going to walk with God through the wilderness. God met them at this mountain. He brought them to this mountain. And at this mountain, God comes down off the mountain. And where does he reside after this? In the tabernacle, in the midst of his people. Before, he had been at the front as a cloudy pillar and fire by night. And then when they came to the Red Sea, he came around and circled behind them. So God is leading them. He's protecting them. But he wasn't ever like in their midst. He brings them to this mountain, says, don't touch. He says, upon pain of death. And then at this mountain, he sets everything up. And then he comes down from the mountain to dwell in their very midst. And then the book of Leviticus talks about clean, unclean, holy, common, or profane. And he starts to set up what this looks like. If I am going to dwell with you, this is how we need to do life together. As we looked in the book of Leviticus, Leviticus is at the center of the five books of Moses. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 3 comes in the exact middle. But the book of Leviticus isn't just in the middle numerically. It's at the center of the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, in a theological way as well. Because in the book of Genesis, we see that God sets up time and space. And he designed time and space for joy, accessing God's presence. In fact, man walked with God in the cool of the garden. And God designed time and space so that he could interact with his creation and his creation could interact with him. That's forfeited in chapter 3. And then we have God working through the process of calling back his creation to himself. And in the book of Leviticus, we see on this Day of Atonement, at the very center of the book of Leviticus, time and space are called to be holy so that God can bring his creation back into fellowship, back into joy, in his very presence once again. But if you see, Genesis moves up to Exodus, moves up to this Day of Atonement, then back down Numbers, Deuteronomy, what we find in the book of Exodus is that God's people, a people that he calls by name, a people that he gives a commission to through their father Abraham, he's given promises to, he's cut a covenant with, and he says, through you I will bless all nations. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. I'll bless all nations through you. I will give you a land, and I will make your seed to abound as many as the stars are in the heavens, as much as there is sand on the seashore. It doesn't look like things are going very well, especially as the first three matriarchs are barren and can't have children. But God miraculously provides one child after another. And by the time we're done with the book of Genesis, 70 people go down to Egypt. But they've moved from Mesopotamia down into the promised land, and then at the end of Genesis, they've moved out of the promised land. And for 400 years, they're going to be in Egypt, and the book of Exodus picks them up as slaves, as those who are in bondage, as those who are in death. And the book of Exodus is written, and it gives us an understanding of God's people being removed from that realm of bondage and death. And he brings them into the wilderness to restore that peace, that joy, that blessing in God's presence. We're moving down from Leviticus. We come down to the book of Numbers, and we see that Numbers then is not the removal from the realm of death, but now a journey to the realm of life. They're not there yet, but that's where they're going. Now, do you understand where the book of Numbers starts to fit? Back in Genesis, the place of God's blessing is lost. In Exodus, God brings them out of bondage, but he hasn't yet brought them to that place of blessing. He's promised to be with them, though, until they get there. And Numbers is the story of God walking with his people to the place of blessing. That's what the book of Numbers is all about. Now, Yeshua is going to bring them into the promised land. And those titles are not given by accident. Yeshua is the same name as what in the New Testament? Jesus. When Jesus brings his people into the promised land, it's not going to be Canaan, it's going to be what? It's going to be heaven. It's going to be God's presence. First, there's going to be the kingdom of God on earth, and then there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. And so shall we ever be with the Lord. This is a promised land. The meek will, in fact, inherit the earth, the whole earth. And so shall we ever be with the Lord. Those titles aren't by accident. And so as the people of Israel are marching through the wilderness, there's a lot that we can begin to identify with these people. They didn't know where they were going until God, by means of the smoke and the cloud, lifts himself from the temple and goes out and says, it's time to go. And so they go. And they didn't know where they were going until God stopped and said, we're camping here. They didn't know what to do, and so they asked God, and God spoke to them. They had questions about life, about consequences. And they would go to God, and he would speak to them through his word, and he would give them direction one day at a time, one need at a time. But we see as they're marching through this wilderness, it's a place that is removed from the blessing in its fullness. Yes, God's presence is there, and yes, God is blessing them. He's making their shoes so that they don't wear out. He's giving them manna day by day, and with each passing moment, strength they're finding to meet their trials here. So he is blessing them on the way, but they're not in that place of blessing. They're not in that realm of blessing, but they're on their way to that place. And so as we work through this book, the book of Numbers is really where we find ourselves today. And that's why Paul in the New Testament, in chapter 10 of the book of 1 Corinthians, says, listen, walk by faith, not by sight. Listen, don't live like a previous generation as they were being taken from the realm of death to the realm of life. They lost their way in the wilderness. They took their eyes off the prize because the now was more real to them than the then. Now was more real to them than later. Don't let that be your downfall in your walk of faith. So as we see, the book of Leviticus is in the middle of this story, but the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers have a lot in common. We see that in the book of Exodus, there's desert journeys coming out of the land of Egypt. In the book of Numbers, there's desert journeys as they move toward the land of Canaan. In the book of Exodus, there's apostasy, a turning away from God, and plagues that follow, particularly for Pharaoh and his people. In the book of Numbers, there's apostasy and plagues that follow, but this time with regard to those who are a part of God's people who don't exercise faith. In the book of Exodus, there's a strong ruler, Pharaoh, and there's magic that's brought into play. He has sorcerers and magicians. In the book of Numbers, we have Balaam, the king of the region, or Balak, the king of the region, and Balaam, his prophet, who really does have some kind of spiritual power. In fact, Balak goes to Balaam because he says, I know that whoever you bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is cursed. This guy is a witch doctor of sorts. He has some spiritual power, but it's not with the God of the Bible. And as he goes to curse Israel, God steps in and says, no, you can't curse my people. I will bless my people regardless of what you try to do to them. An amazing thing. And then we see that there's, in the book of Exodus, a lot of focus on the firstborn, the Passover, all the firstborn of Egypt are killed, and the Levites are called out to be those who take the redemption price of God's people for all the firstborn. And again, in the book of Numbers, there's going to be a lot of reference to the Levites in reference to taking the place of the firstborn. So there's a lot of equals and similarities between the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers as far as some of the materials are concerned. As we go through this book, it's been nicknamed, that has nothing to do with anything at this point, but the book of Numbers has been nicknamed the junk room of the priestly code. It seems like it's kind of thrown together. If you try to read this and try to make sense of the whole book, all 36 chapters, you'll be going through, and you kind of lose your way pretty quickly. Because the content of this book, there's stories. We mentioned some of them already. There's numbers. There's census lists. There's laws. There's travel itineraries. There's battle accounts. There's legal disputes. There's worship practices. There's feasts that are given. There's sacrificial rites that are explained. You're like, how does this make sense? How come we were just talking about Moses dying and disobeying God, and all of a sudden he's leading them into battle? How does this work? How come we just talked about these men who broke faith with God? They'll never enter the promised land. And the next chapter talks about, so when you're in the promised land, do this. It's like, how does this work? How is this connected? Fee and Stewart, as they write in their book, How to Read the Bible Book by Book, when it comes to the book of Numbers, they say, if Leviticus tends to be an unappealing book to contemporary readers, then the book of Numbers must be one of the most difficult in terms of what in the world is going on. Okay, that's good. I like that. Except when you have to try to explain it. Ian DeGeed, in his commentary, says, this is one book where it's extremely helpful to have a sense of the overall organization of the book before we plunge into the details. This is all the more important, paradoxically enough, precisely because the book at first sight doesn't seem to have much order to it. And so as we come to this book, there is some large structure that we do have to keep in mind. And if we can keep this in mind, it'll help us to understand what's going on. God's people currently live their lives in the wilderness. I think we've established that fact as we've tried to lay that out this morning. God's people are en route from the land of bondage and death to the land of freedom and life. But right now they're at this in-between. They're in between two worlds, if you will. This is a travelogue of sorts. And as they move from Egypt, the land of bondage and death, to Canaan, the land of freedom and life, or blessing and life, they're going to be making this move. And so the story is set up as traveling from Mount Sinai to the wilderness of Paran. And then they're going to review some things. Some things are going to happen there. They're going to go into the promised land. They're going to come back and they're going to decide, let's not do it. Let's not go there. Let's not follow God to the land of promise. And so they're going to wander around in the wilderness for 40 years. And over the course of those 40 years, that generation is going to die because they refused to trust God. And so God says, okay, you don't want to go in the promised land? I won't let you. And so for 40 years, they die off. And then, chapter 20, they're done. They're dead. So they start to move. And as they start to move, they start to win. And they start to move forward. They start to make progress. And they move to Moab. Moab is right on the edge of the promised land. It's Transjordan. And it's there that they defeat Sihon. And they defeat Og. And three of the tribes say, hey, this is pretty good land. How about we take this land, Moses, And they actually begin to establish some of the inheritance right there. And God begins to bless his people. But what happens right here? This is generation number one. This is generation number two. In chapters 1 through 4, we have a census. That census comes out to, what is it, 630,000? I forget what it is when it's all said and done. It ends up being 603,550. 603,550. But over the course of their disobedience, God says all of them have to die, all of them will die, and so all of them do die. So they all die here in the wilderness of Paran, and as they move forward, it's a second generation. They make some mistakes. They make some pretty hefty mistakes at the very beginning. But the time we get to chapter 26, right there on the edge of Moab, right there on the edge of Canaan, we find that they take a census again. At this point, there's 601,730, almost 602,000, almost exactly the same amount of people as have died. They're down by 1,500 people or so. But what happens is this book is organized around a generation of disobedience and then a generation of obedience. The generation of disobedience dies off. There's consequences. The generation of obedience is going to move forward to the land of God's blessing. And that's really what structures this book. The census at the beginning of all the people who are going to die because they refuse to obey. The census at the end, after some pretty big mistakes are made right here in the middle. But after chapter 26, nobody dies. Nobody dies. They're moving forward together in obedience to the place of their inheritance. The theme of this book then is learning to walk by faith. Okay? This generation never did. We went through the book of Romans here kind of in a quick overview, just a real quick flyby, if you will, through the course of the summer. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God unto all who believe, to the Jew first, also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it is written, what? The just shall live by faith. This is the people of God. But this generation never learned how to walk by faith. But that's not the end of the story. Because this generation did. This generation did. So the theme of this book is learning to walk by faith in the wilderness, in the time in between this world of death and this world of life, walking by faith, even though we're not there yet, but being absolutely dead sure that we're going to get there. There's a phrase that's repeated over and over some 29 times in this book, and the phrase is with reference to God, and the phrase is this, and he spoke, and he spoke, and he spoke. Or, and he said, and he said. And the point of this repetition of this phrase and then the content that follows is that God is present and God is giving direction along with his people. You think of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leads me beside the still waters. He leads me. Oh, boy, somebody quote that for me. I just lost it. Paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for... Okay, that's the point. God the shepherd is leading them into green pastures and still waters, and he's promised to be with them. And they don't know where to go next, so what do? They listen to him speak. They ask, and they watch, and they listen. We're going to get down to... Oh, I forget which chapter it is. But it says, and they kept the charge of the Lord. And they kept the charge of the Lord. And they kept the charge of the Lord. They obeyed. They listened. They followed. That's the point. And God is with his people as they're going from point A to point B, but he's taking them there. And they'll get there successfully so long as they keep the charge of the Lord, as they listen, as they follow, as they submit, as they obey. So we've kind of given a basic outline of what this looks like. There's more sophisticated outlines, but if you can just keep in mind that the first half of the book is the generation that dies because of faithless disobedience. The second half of the book is a generation that's learning to walk by faith in the wilderness. You're going to get it. You're going to get it. So as we come to this book of Numbers, we need to understand that God is instructing his people as they learn to walk by faith in this wilderness life. So what we see is one of the big themes is that God's people currently reside in the wilderness. But we see that the wilderness is a place of conflict for God's people. As we look through chapter 1, let's go back there, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting on the first day of the second month, second year after they'd come out of the land of Egypt, and he said, "Take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel, by clans, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, all in Israel who are what?" This is a what kind of camp? This isn't a KOA campground. This isn't a family leisure camp where they've got the swimming pool in the center of the compound and the game room and the s'mores available for you. This is a war camp. The wilderness is a place of conflict for God's people. And at the center of the camp is God. God in his presence, as he's manifesting himself, as he's speaking, as he's giving direction, as he's telling them when to move, when not to move, God is there with his people. But this is a war camp, because the wilderness is a place of conflict. Now, sometimes, frequently, that conflict comes from the outside. In the desert, there's snakes. And so you come to a pretty gruesome snake story where Moses is going to raise up the serpent and they're going to be saved from the deadly snakes that are there in the desert. They're because of their own unfaithfulness, we'll find out. There's snakes. There's no water in the wilderness. And so they're going to complain and ask God for water. There's no food. And so they're gripe, and God's going to bring quail, so much quail that it's going to come out their nostrils, he says, and before they're even able to eat it, he begins to kill them because they didn't trust him. They didn't trust him. So frequently, the conflicts in the wilderness are from the outside. You know, as we walk in our life of faith, a lot of the conflict that we experience comes from outside. It comes from just being in the fact that we're dwelling in the wilderness. Some of the stuff that we wrestle with by faith or by sight is the fact that we have a mortgage to pay. We walk by faith or we walk by sight when we have an automobile that needs repair. It's just what happens in the wilderness. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just what is. Now, how we respond to it makes all the difference in the world. But these are problems that are external to us. On the outside, there are enemies. We have the prophet, Balaam, who is invoking death on God's people. At least that's what he's paid to do. And so there's people who are actively working on the outside to suppress God's people. Have we seen any of that recently? Is there any enemy to truth and to God's word? Has there been any movement in the United States of America to try remove prayer from schools? That was a generation ago. That was before my time. Was there any push within this great nation to try take the lives of unborn children because mothers don't want them? These are pressures from the outside. Is there any push from outside of God's people to be accepting of whatever sexual way you want to go? Okay. These are pressures that are from the outside. Why? Because we're dwelling in the wilderness. These are external pressures, and they're really pressures that are targeting us, making us an enemy. Why? Because we're on God's side. Because God brought us out of this mess of death, and God is bringing us to the blessing of life. We no longer fit with that. And Jesus says, because you are not of the world, therefore the world will what? It will hate you. It will hate you. It will work against you. And that's what happens in the wilderness. Frequently, the pressures in the wilderness are from the outside, but not always. Because in the wilderness, often, the tension arises from the inside. We come to chapter 12, and we see that Aaron and Miriam begin to say, Moses, what's up with you, bud? Like, you're so smarty pants, little brother. God talks to us too, and they challenge his authority, and God has to step in and say, enough. And Miriam contracts leprosy and is put outside the camp for 7 days. Sometimes the pressure's from within. Sometimes it's not what's out there, it's us right here. You don't have to go any farther than your own home. You don't have to come together as a church. Sometimes the tension's right in the four walls of your own house. It was for Moses. His brother and his sister are a part of the conflict as they work through this. Sometimes the conflict is even closer than that. What we see, we'll go back one here. We have Aaron and Miriam, but a little bit later we have the sons of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. These are guys, the one is a Levite, and he's camping next to these Reubenites on one side of the tabernacle, and they come up and say, Moses, Aaron, all of us are God's people. Who do you think you are to say, make a prince of yourself over us? You can't do that. Again, God's people working against themselves on this wilderness journey. But the biggest problem that we see in the wilderness isn't from the outside. The biggest problem is from the inside. Now, we've said it several times, especially in our Sunday school classes, but we really do have to get to the place where we believe that our biggest problem is ourselves. My biggest problem is sin. That sin that resides in my flesh. The sin that takes up the same space as my new man and God's Spirit. That sin that's right here with me wherever I go. That is my biggest problem. Right here in the wilderness. One day, praise God, that's not going to be my problem. I'm going to be removed from the realm of sin. And that won't be my problem anymore. But right now, it is. And so their greatest adversary is themselves. In chapter 11, they complain. And God's anger is kindled against them. In chapter 11, they lust, they crave, they want. In chapter 13, they fear. In chapter 14, they grumble. And it's interesting the role that grumbling and complaining plays in this book. Because it usually starts with one. And then it reaches out to many. In fact, the grumbling usually doesn't stay grumbling. If you'll look at these texts, it usually moves on to crying and weeping. I mean, you talk about depression. Numbers talks about self-inflicted negativity that results in depression and tears. Why? Because they're not walking by faith, they're walking by sight. And as long as you focus on the here and now, you're going to be negative. You're going to be depressed. You're going to be discouraged. You're going to weep. That's not what you're designed for. In chapter 14, there's disbelief. In chapter 20, when Moses strikes the rock, you know why he did it? Because of disbelief. In chapter 20, there's quarreling. In chapter 21, they're impatient, or the word could be they're discouraged. The life has been sucked out of them. Their spirit is small. Their spirit is short. In chapter 25, there's idolatry. And wherever there's disobedience, it always leads, it always leads, it always leads to death. That's why James writes, "But every man is drawn away of his own lust. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Do not err, my beloved brothers. Do not err. Sin always leads down the pathway of death. But obedience always brings life." God's ways always lead to life. So in the wilderness, it's a place of conflict, conflict for God's people. And where there's disobedience, it always leads to death. That's why Numbers is a graveyard book, especially up through chapter 19, as all of that generation dies. One of the most encouraging things in this book is the fact that God's people are names. They're not numbers. Go back to chapter 1. You there? Look at verse 2. "Take a census, Moses, of all the congregation of the people of Israel by clans, by fathers' houses, according to the number..." According to the number of what? According to the number of names. That same phrase is used again in verse 18. According to the number of names. Verse 20, verse 22, 24, 26, 28, 30, 32, 34, 36, 38, 40, 42. What's God concerned with? Numbers or names? Names, names, names. In fact, he says, "Moses, this is going to be a pretty big job." So look at verse 5. "So these are the names of the men who shall assist you." Verse 16, "These are the ones chosen from the congregation." Verse 17, "So Moses and Aaron took these men who had been," what? Named. They've been named. Who spoke their name to Moses? God did. God did. In fact, I love how it comes down here. Let's go down to verse 20. So we're just going to take Reuben as one of the examples of how God does this census. "The people of Reuben, Israel's firstborn, their generations, by their clans," so this is the tribe, and then they break down by clans, and then their clans, they break down by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, "head by head, every man among them." And God wants a list of every single name. It's a little ominous because in this first section, all of those names are going to be attached to gravestones before it's all said and done. But when we get to the next section, chapter 26, all of those names have a place in the promised land before it's all said and done. And God has a property with their name on it. I think this is one of the most encouraging things about this book of Numbers, because it's really not about numbers, it's about names. Names that God knows. Names that God has written down. You sing that song? "There's a new name written down in glory, and it's mine. Oh yes, it's mine." I love how Paul says, now in Galatians, you know God, or rather, you are known of God. It's not so much that you know God, but the fact that God knows you. God knows you by name. That's what's important. That's what makes all the difference in this. God's people are names and not numbers. And so we see that as we work through this, these are the stories of people, people with faces. People with faces like Moses and Aaron and Miriam. People who fail in their leadership and die outside the promised land. People with names like Joshua and Caleb, who are concerned about God's leadership, who are filled with God's Spirit, who are concerned about God's promises and God's people. We come into this and we see the names of women as well as men. There's the daughters of Zelophehad. They're fatherless. They're husbandless. When it draws you into this story, you feel sorry for these gals, but not for long, because these are valiant women. They say, listen, Moses, we don't have a father, we don't have husbands, but we want the land. We believe God's promise, and we want our names in God's blessing. Wow, way to go, girl. That's that kind of a girl. And these are people with names and faces that you want to be like. Or like Korah, you don't. These are names. And it reminds us that God is aware of the workings of each one of his people. But it reminds us that each of these names, each of these people has a place. And so on this side, you have Judah and Issachar and Zebulun. And on the next side, you have Reuben and Simeon and Gad. And on the next side, you have Dan and Asher and Naphtali and Ephraim and Manasseh and Benjamin. And you have these people around in the middle. You have Gershom or Kohath and Gershom and Merari. And up here is Aaron and Moses. And every man has a place. They have a place to fight. They have a place to move. These people all go out first. And then the Gershomites and the Merarites bringing certain things to do. They have a place in the battle, or they have a place in the temple, in the tabernacle, the place of meeting. These people aren't fighters. These people are protectors of God's glory. They keep this from getting dirty, and they keep this protected from the holiness of God. These people right here are at the center of the camp because God is. And God says, I want them as insulators, if you will, from my holiness and me from their dirtiness. And he says, now if you're in this camp, you have to be clean. If you're not clean, get out of the camp. And they're going to take time to do that early on. And God moves this war camp, but every person has a place. You ever feel like you get lost in the shuffle? The book of Numbers says that you have a name to God and you're not lost in the shuffle. God guarantees there's a place for you in his program. That's why a couple weeks ago we did that survey of gifts. Every one of us who knows Jesus Christ as Savior has been given a gift to use in his service. But we see as this book of Numbers continues to play out that it reminds us that God's presence is with his people. God is in the center of this camp, and as he's there, he's organizing all of life. All of the book of Leviticus that we just looked at, things you can eat, things you can't eat. Things you can touch, things you can't touch. Places you can go, places you can't go. Times you can enjoy for yourself, times you can't enjoy for yourself. Times you can work, times you can't work. God is governing all of life. He's organizing life, he's giving it purpose, and he's giving it direction. He's moving us from here to there. He's moving us from death to life. That's the purpose of this God in his camp. He's giving protection and power. And so the ark goes out with God's people. And when the ark goes out with God's people, they win. And God is with them. But when they go out without the ark, when they go out without their God, there's no protection. There's no power. God's not with them. He's in the middle of the camp, giving them strength, giving them provision. He's feeding them. He's watering them. Even when Moses beats the rock rather than speaking to the rock, God proves himself as holy by doing what he said he was going to do. And he gives the people the water that they need. Why? Because there's no water if God doesn't give it to them. But he does, because he's there. As they keep working through, they sin. And time after time after time, God gives them mercy. A couple different times through the course of this book, Moses stands between God and the people and says, God, no, no. For your sake, because of your word, because of your glory, God, don't do it. And God put Moses there for that, to give us a picture of Jesus, by the way. Moses was God's provision to stay his own hand from judgment on his people. And God gives mercy. And because God gives mercy, he's able to give grace. And we see by the end of the story that you have this Balaam character who's trying to call down the curse of the gods, the curse of this God in particular upon this people. But God, in his sovereignty, removes the curse and brings a blessing as it speaks of a coming king from this people. This is an amazing story. This is a really good book because it meets us right where we're at. We ourselves are now between two worlds. We're living life in the wilderness. God's called us out of the realm of death. He's bringing us to the realm of life. We're here, though. We're not there yet. We're stuck in the middle. But we're not stuck by ourselves. We're stuck here with our God, who's present, blessing, giving mercy, giving grace, going with us, giving direction. He's speaking to us. If only we'll listen. If only we'll trust. If only we'll learn to walk by faith. We're living right now life in the wilderness. It's not Egypt to Canaan. It's earth to heaven. It's from now till then. It's from here till there. And as we learn to live this life, the call of the book of Numbers is to learn now to live life in light of the God who's the God of all life. So as you go back to work this week, live this life this week in light of the God who's moving you from the realm of death to the realm of life. As we've gone through the book of Genesis, the book of Exodus, the book of Leviticus, the book of Numbers, I want you to just kind of see how they've kind of built on each other. In the book of Genesis, we saw that our lives are a part of God's story. Your life is a part of God's story. In the book of Exodus, we saw that God is at work inside his story on behalf of his people so that he can be at work inside his people to carry forward his story. In the book of Leviticus, we saw that all of God has to affect all of our lives, all of the time. And now, in the book of Numbers, we see that right now we have to learn to walk by faith. Right now we have to live in light of God, who is the God of all life. Go to Psalm 95 as we close this morning, if you would, please. Psalm 95. Complaining, murmuring, grumbling, quarreling, discouragement, weeping, crying. That's what characterizes the book of Numbers. Psalm 95. Oh, come, let us sing. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Coming into his presence with thanksgiving, joyful noise, songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God, a great King above all gods. Verse 6. Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God. We are the people of his pasture. We are the sheep of his hand. What's the next word? Today. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts, as that generation did at Meribah, as on that day at Massa in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, even though they saw my work, and for 40 years I did what to that generation? I loathed them. I put up with them. They were a grief to my spirit. And they are a people who go astray in their hearts. They have not known my ways. Therefore I swore in my wrath, they'll never enter my rest. Psalm chapter 95 says, listen, here is your past failure. I'm telling you, your future is going to be failure if you follow that same path. But what have you been given there in verse 7? You've been given today. today? What are you going to do with today? Are you going to walk by faith? Or are you going to walk by sight? You've been given today so you can learn to walk by faith right here in the wilderness.